our host, Professor Enzo Pace from University of Padova. He recently retired. He was professor of sociology. He was head of department of sociology at the University of Padova. Also well-known international scholars. He was general secretary and president of the International Society for the Sociology of Religion. And I'm very pleased I can hear your lecture, Enzo.
Thank you. Thank you, Sinisha. Okay, the topic is summarizing this rhetoric question. Can religions play a progressive role in advancing human rights? If I start with this various case studies all over the world, no? Just we start with this very well-known Kukux Klan, or with Russia as a Rita Sang, this, how to say, a very radical neo-Hinduist movement that supported the new government in India. He was the protagonist of this attack at Babri Masjid in Ayodhya in 1982, destroyed completely, historical mosque in India. This is one of the most radical Indonesian movement that is trying to change a little bit the constitutional structure of this important Asian country because of this 2,000 million people with 82-83% of Muslims, but the constitution there was no declaration that Islam is the religion of the state. But this is a strong movement to change the constitution. On your right, you can meet this important leader, the venerable monk, Buddhist monk in Sri Lanka, who founded in 2012 a Bodhu Bala Sena, the force of the power of the Buddhism. He's a monk who organized a very important rally against the halal practices among the Muslim communities in Sri Lanka. It's a historical community, it's not a newcomer, it's a historical date from the 18th century, or against the new Christian evangelical churches in the name of the Sinhalese Buddhist identity, national identity of Sri Lanka. Then, of course, you know this very famous declaration by this fundamentalist preacher in the United States, Jerry Falwell. This is Walayata Faqih. Walayata Faqih is one of the most important pillar, constitutional pillar of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Look at, in particular, look at the Article 5. No, during the occultation of the Wali Al-Ansar, alas, occultation means that in Shia, people are expecting and waiting the return of the Imam, disappeared in the 19th century. The Vilaya, at leadership of Umar de Bola, the Vilaya Afaki, who is fully aware of the circumstances of his age, courageous, resourceful, and the process of administrative ability, will assume the responsibilities of this office. It means it's the only body not elected. And this body has the supreme power to scrutinize all the bills approved in the parliament, to scrutinize the list of the deputies in the campaign, electoral campaign. So it means actually a theocracy. In spite of the history of the relationship between Shia and the foundation of the state during the Safavid period. Because during the Safavid period, the Ayatollah maintained a separate function with the political sphere. There was a sort of division of labor between politics and religion. And with Khomeini, who led the Iranian revolution, this traditional historical compromise between politics and religion has been completely subverted. And this is the result. This is, of course, well known when you go to Jerusalem or Tel Aviv in other neighborhoods marked by the presence of extreme ultra-Orthodox Jews. You can see this advice. This is a very, very interesting story occurred in Anglican Communion, when in United Kingdom arose this question of the marriage between an Anglican priest and his friend. And in Africa, the Anglican bishops declared that this recognition of homosexuality for priests as is impossible to recognize. This is an evil manifestation, and they condemned some priests in Africa, in Uganda, and so on. This is a very nice comparison between two declarations by Francis, Pope Francis, about sex marriage. The first one was this, if someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has good will, who am I to judge? But now he was able to be more precise. That, of course, in any case, sex marriage has been prohibited. Okay, if in the contemporary religious landscape the culture of human rights is questioned, criticized, in whole or in part, and denied, in fact, many, many societies, not only Muslim society, it's my point of view, by religious fundamentalist movement in all its various forms and shades that we know in different religious environments, I try to show you, by recurring violent conflicts of political and economic nature involving religions, to the extent that such conflicts in this contemporary world may appear as actual conflicts between religions. In that case, I could end my paper now, because the game between this paradigm of human rights and the role of religion in contemporary society would already be closed and lost. Game is over. But because I, of course, pessimistic in reason, but optimistic in will, I would like to try to argue that, in spite of this dramatic picture, with some other picture that Aileen showed us now, I would like to refresh my memory as intellectual about a theoretical approach introduced by a prominent German jurist, who tried to show that, of course, there are philosophical and political fundamentals of human rights, but we have to remind that there are also a religious source of human rights. Of course, philosophy, politics, you know from Glorious Revolution, United Kingdom, the formation of a new nation in the United States, and French Revolution. But when Georg Jelinek tried to explain this very important book, The Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, in 1895, that the first universal declaration, according to Jelinek, of the rights of man was made during the American Revolution. This is a historical fact. And it formed the matrix of the French Revolution, which only told in fact to the influence of Rousseau. Consequently, the cultural origin of the declaration are religious in nature, among other elements. This thesis was taken up not only by jurists, other jurists in Germany, but also philosophers and German sociologists, particularly Ernst Troeltsch and Max Weber. Ernst Troeltsch, writing on the occasion of Jelinek's death, the obituary, attributed to him the merit of having linked the origin of the paradigm of human rights to Protestant sects, particularly Baptists, the Quakers, partially Calvinist formation. Max Weber, on the other hand, though directly interested in the matter of human rights, on several occasions acknowledged his debt to Jelinek in the formulation of his fundamental thesis contained the work The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. In the last pages of this book, there's a sort of prophecy. One of the rare sociologists who tried to to prophesize, when he used this Nietzschean sentence that the capitalism will develop a society more and more not interested in ascetic, only spirituality, because more and more this kind of society will need spiritualist without spirit, and sensualist without art. We are precisely in this moment in contemporary society. So Hans Joas, who has the merit to have reopened in sociology debate the question of human rights and religion, remind us the relevance of Jelinek. He said, within 20th century German thought there developed in the sociology and juridical domain a school of thought which traced its origin to Jelinek, who explicitly reflected on the religious origin, Judeo-Christian to be precise, of human rights in open polemic with the anti-religious view of the origin of human rights. So if I try to start with this argument, I think I could provide an answer to the first question I posed at the beginning of my speech. What does it mean to speak about the religious origin of human rights in contemporary society? First, we are investigating one of the shattered contradictions in modern society. On the one hand, modern society exalts the primacy and inviolability of individual freedom, and on the other, it expects individuals to recognize and respect the existence of universal ethical and juridical principles. Second, in sociological terms, when we speak of human rights, actually, we use a sort of a sociometric indicator of the contents. We ask if something exists at higher level than a particular interest, which can keep individuals together so that they feel they form society. To put in another way, we could ask how is the social order possible without a collective consciousness that makes people believe in the existence, believe in Durkheimian sense, believe in the existence of norms that are superior to the will of the individuals. Thirdly, the third reason that links the theme of human rights to sociology and sociology of religion is consequential. Human rights may constitute a powerful indicator of a type of conflict which is recurrent in the history of human society and which we can classify as conflicts of values in that they are not directly linked to the interest or the apparently utilitarian dimension of human life, but rather concern acts of divine will or sacred. When we look at the history of the relation between the religious imagination and the political imagination in the story of American Puritans, they did not expect the state to guarantee their freedom of belief, but rather that the state would not interfere with the plan God had assigned to them for the creation of a holy community, the kingdom of heaven on earth, the New Jerusalem, Jerusalem on the hill. This necessarily led them to decide a late state. The real problem up to now. The example shown by Eileen is clearly when the state tried to impose a rule. It's not a late state, it's an evil state, which was not only neutral to all institutional religion, but rather respectful of the principle of moral self-determination, which each individual required to achieve higher goals. What does it mean in my mind? I think that if every religion is able to reflect on its internal humanistic message, liberating this internal humanistic message from the recurrent attempt, effort to transform this humanistic message in a system of believing, stuffed with norms, precepts, that accurately try to scrutinize every little human decision. I think it's the mortification of the humanistic message of religion. The tension is according to my point of view, the liberation of the freedom to have a religious experience is the presumption that is able to root the paradigm of human rights and to destroy all this attempt to transform a living world, the humanistic message of religion, into a systematic creation of a social order. This is the problem up to now. So in this sense, the question of human rights arises when a religion presents itself as an all-round system of belief. And sometimes when this system has been created, it's a fantastic tool for a political system to use this religious power in order to implement and to impose a political power. Many religions has been used in this sense. Many leaders were fascinated by this powerful capacity of religion to discipline the human behaviors and to impose not universal human rights, but universal imperial rule. No. It's the story. It's not only the story of Christianity under Constantine and Theodosian period, but it's the story of Buddhism with King Ashoka. It's the story about imperial Islam. When the Jews, the class of Jews has been created in order to implement the development and the political expansion of this empire. In the language of a monotheistic religion, of this talk, this corresponds with the idea of the law of God, which covers all aspects of human life, be they interior, social, moral, juridical, or political. In other words, all the spheres of the society has been ordered toward this obedience to law. It's clear for me that Judaism and Islam are more sensitive to this kind of logic, social logic or theologic, less to Christianity, since the original message of Jesus the Nazarite, who not starting from open criticism like law, shifts the symbolic confines of the previous rabbinical tradition. No? He tries to observe the Shabbat, but the Shabbat is made for man and not man for the Shabbat. It's in this sense, it's an affirmation about the humanistic meanings of a religious message, not the obedience to a law. Or you can obey to the religious law only if you are intimately convinced that this is coincided with your production of individual meanings. This is my question. What happens when the tension between the freedom of belief, but I try to translate this formula, freedom of belief, that the right of individual to have a humanistic religious experience, able to produce herself or himself some meanings, when this right is limited, repressed, control, of course, we have the primacy of the obedience. And this problem of many Muslim society, in which they accumulated the principle of obedience. And one of the indicators is the growth at a certain moment of the imperial political story of Abbasid period, growth of a new religious movement, according to language of the Sufi. The first was a sort of attempt to resituate the rights of the individual to have humanistic religious experience, in spite of the primacy of the obedience to the law, the Sharia. In this sense, there's many break point when groups and movements of beliefs descend in the name of human rights at this moment. in Indonesia, in Tunisia, in Russia, in United States, and so on. In this sense, I would like to say very short sentence about Islam. I think this artificial sense of the argument, artificial distinction between the first message and the second message in the history of a religion is very important for our topic. Because sometimes when you look at the original movement of creation of a new religious language promoted by prophets, mystical masters, and so on. Okay, when we study this, first stage of the new religious language, before this religious language become a system of believing, become religion in our conventional term. The question concerns the complex relationship between the words of a prophet or seer, in the case of Veda, that have inspired a new religious belief and the process of sorting out what these words are announced, a task usually undertaken, but is disciples. The passage from living word, first message of the prophet, the founder of religion, to the writing down of what is later regarded as the Holy Scripture, is a first systematization of the living word. And then to process of, system building, religious system building, that produce norms, a set of norms, present lifestyles and so on, including dressing, alimentary diet and so on. It's a process which can be measured both by the passing of time and by the difficulties encountered by the community of disciples when they attempt to agree on what the founder prophet really said and what should be handed down. So, since the final passage of the construction of a system of belief is supported by political actors, the living force of the primitive world tends to become a principle of order, and the living world will be domesticated, will be, transformed in an instrument, a tool. And in this sense, a principle of it means, particularly in modern society, according to me, the problem of the relation between human rights and Islam is not in abstract sense. As story point of view, in the history of this society, marked, shaped by the Islam tradition, the problem is the accumulation of principle of obedience. Obey God, obey God to the Prophet, okay, but obey the Caliph. The second was a fantastic juridical, political machinery to transform a living world, the first message of Muhammad, the first message of Prophet, into a system. A system well organized, well defined, and so on. When you give this advising, please read a very interesting book edited by Adam Possamay, Jim Richardson, Brian Tarn, Sociology of Sharia. It's a very useful book in which you can see a comparison between very, very various cases around the world about this question I have mentioned. In this sense, I'm moving to the conclusion. For me, it's very crucial, from the theoretical point of view, in order to assume a criterion in order to understand why in some religion is possible a moderate approach to human rights or complete absence, and why in other this approach is so difficult with some complex obstacles and so on. If we would like to refresh this very nice sentence by this man, Sebastian Frank, German, how to say, mystical thinker. He was a former Catholic priest, then he moved to Lutheranism, and then he abandoned also the Lutheran Church. He was closer to Society of Brother, and a Baptist. He tried to combine the humanist passion for freedom of religion with the mystic's devotion of the religion of spirits. It's precisely my translation of this idea in sociological terms. Humanistic religious experience and the resilience against only any attempt by the system of religion to discipline my soul. So it means we have to look at the many ways adopted by religion in various contexts to keep in order the spirit of the living world within reasonable limits. So the comparative study of religion showed that the construction of a system of dogma, norms, precepts is often the results of a complex negotiation, punctuated with conflicts between various points of view formed within a religious community. It's the case precisely of Islam, the case of Sharia. Sharia is the final result of a long process of interpretation of the Quran, Hadith, Ijma, the jurisprudence and so on. Why otherwise Islam has met four in Sunni tradition, four juridical theological schools, not one, four. And then you have two other schools in Shia. There's a juridical plurality, or it's possible to interpret this juridical spirituality as the indicator that in spite of the dogmatic approach imposed by the political regime in many Muslim society, Quran has been always interpreted. And this it is the tool to take into account when we discuss what Muslim intellectuals and so on, in order to encourage those who are supporting the battle for the human rights. In the name of religious fundamental principle contained in the first message or second message of the Muhammad. The law, therefore, presents itself as the insuperable boundary, the decisive symbolic border to define not only the religious identity but also the social one of all those who have recognized themselves in a given religious message. I have Matt, you know, because of Silvio Ferrari, I didn't mention this question. If we compare the draft, the Cairo Declaration on Human Rights in 1919, it was a results of a very interesting compromise, political compromise between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Now it was impossible to sign the same draft. But when you look at the final declaration, the Article 24, all the rights and freedoms stipulated in this declaration are subject to the Islamic Sharia. What does mean Sharia? In Saudi Arabia, Wahhabit interpretation, or in the Yatafaki Shia tradition, what's Sharia? In this sense, it's more advanced it's interesting in this sense, more advanced the Arabic draft, where of course there are a mention of Islam, but the first assumption is that the Arab civilization is a sort of hub of not only Islam, but other religions. In this sense, we have a progressive approach to, of course, there are limits of, but it's a traditional limits of. In this sense, we are facing with a paradox in the Muslim world, because on the other hand, you have like this man who died, executed by the dictatorship Limeyre in 1985, who wrote this famous book, The Second Message of Islam, in which he tried to argue that Islam is compatible with human rights if Muslim theology, Muslim intellectual, Muslim movement of civil society are able to reinterpret, reopen the interpretation of the Quran and rediscover the humanistic side of the message, the second message. The book is the second message. It means the Islam not yet realized, not yet understood. Now we have a very sharp fitna, new fitna. It's not Islam incompatible with us, our to human rights. There's a battle within Muslim society. And then you have, there's some famous scholar, Mohammed Akun, Nasr Abuzaid, died. We hosted Nasr Abuzaid in Padua for a very important course on Sharia and human rights. But we have the pupil of Mahmoud Abdullahi Naim, who's a scholar of Emory University, United States. So it means there is space. This is, I'm not desperate. I'm not desperate because I see during the Arab, so-called Arab Spring, or during the Green Wave in Iran, before the Arab Spring, there are some emergence of the human rights question. In the name of human rights, there's a political battle, there's a political question. Thank you very much.